The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
The Chinese, they do not have the visual capacity for hard work, and above all, they cannot change. And this is the most powerful man in Asian politics for many decades, and even now, at the age of like 92, he's still a very much influential force. So in this quote, Mahathir actually is summarizing the present views on the lazy Malays. He doesn't actually agree with all of it. He agrees with most of it, except the last part. He believes that they can change, and it's part of his political project to help the Malays change from their lazy behavior into skilled capitalists, basically. So a little bit more ethnic context is just that Malaysia has a population of 31 million. 68.6% of the population is Bumiputra, which literally means princes of the soil. And that encompasses the Malays and a few other ethnic groups, but mainly predominantly the Malays. And then you have 23.4% Chinese and 7% Indians. This is helpful to know when I'm presenting about these political dynamics, about what the rough demographics are. And I'm focusing on a particular subset of Malaysians, particularly Malaysian Malays, which is the professional managerial class, which is a term that some of you may be familiar with. It was first proposed by, I think, Barbara Ehrenreich, yes. And so salaried workers whose function can be described broadly as the reproduction of capitalist culture and class relations. And the reason why I focus on this group is that the identity of the PMC Malays corresponds quite nicely with a term in Malaysia which is called Melayu Baru, or the New Malays. And because it's, I like the term because it's not only serves as a comparative in opposition to the majority or the working class, but that it focuses very much on the reproduction of capitalist culture. It's not just a material basis, but also the cultural basis for neoliberal capitalism. And so we're talking about roughly 20% of the population, academics, engineers, managers, cultural workers, bankers, and so on. Those are the people that I'm looking at. So this is basically my thesis in a nutshell. So the lazy Malay stereotype is reappropriated in different historical formations, from colonial period to post-colonial period to the present neoliberal period. And this has this racial project has a purpose. The purpose is to promote forms of neoliberal rationality, legitimize new forms of social inequality, establish notions of who deserves material wealth and who doesn't. And that professional managerial class Malays play a unique role in sustaining this racial project. And just to give you a comparison, a different viewpoint is like from Alvin Babushka, who some of you may have heard of as a Montparnasse Society Fellow and a Hoover Institute Fellow. He's most well known for like writing tax policies for the Hoover Institute, but he actually did his PhD on East Asian studies, and a lot of his like first journal articles was on Malaysia. And so he says that stereotypes do not significantly influence social or political behavior. Efforts to eradicate stereotypes may be misdirected. So he doesn't see a political purpose behind it, and whereas I'm trying to propose that there is one. So I'm just going to give first. I'm going to give like a historical argument, trace it to the history, and after I'm going to give present some qualitative data which supports my argument. So the process of racialization is very much intertwined with European colonialism. That's not to say that before that, inter-ethnic tensions did not exist, but it was mainly understood in terms of religion rather than in terms of racial ideology. So another feature is that colonial capitalism produced very ethnicized division of labor. So one of the reasons for this is simply that much of the Malay community worked as fishermen or farmers, whereas the Chinese and Indian immigrants worked in colonial plantations, in mines and plantations. This is very much a deliberate part of the British divide and rule strategy, which made a conscious attempt not to disrupt the Malay peasantry because they encountered a lot of resistance when they first started doing so. And so the Malays were stigmatized partly because due to their own self-sufficiency and their own insulation from colonial wage labor. So one cultural critic, Zaidun Sada, puts it, the Malays performed no useful function in the contours of colonial capitalism. The Chinese were integral part of its expansion. So that's very much part of the origin of the myth. Just to give some brief overview of how the British viewed the Malays back then, Frank Secondhand is a British resident. He said that whatever the cause, the Malay of the peninsula was and is unquestionably opposed to steady, continuous work. This was not even like the most drastic view. There was also another British writer who said that the Malay is the most steadfast loafer on the face of the earth because they spend 9/10 of their waking hours resting in the shade, which is, you know, obviously it's just not just physically possible for someone to be to actually exist in that state. So what happened in the post-colonial era? So one of the things that happened was that after 1957, when Malaysia got independence, Malays continued to be excluded from the benefits of economic growth because industries and occupations were organized according to race. And this ethnic divide entrenched differences between in educational and employment outcomes, with the exception of a few Malay elites who enjoyed access to elite schools, to scholarships, and civil service employments. And another thing that happened was that the myth of lazy Malay increasingly became adopted by Malay elites themselves. And most famous example of this is in Mental Revolution, or Mental Revolusi, which is written by Mahathir Mohamad before he was Prime Minister. Basically, it argued that the influence of the environment in Malaya led to the weakening of Malay character. Because of the abundance of resources and convenient geographic location, even the weakest and least diligent were able to live in comparative comfort, marry, and procreate. Now, this led to the creation of a new economic policy, which was established to redistribute wealth, which can be understood as a nationalist project driven by capitalist impulses. So this was use of state intervention in order to facilitate affirmative action policies, including the preferential hiring based on ethnicity, providing Bumiputra with easy access to credit, and funding to acquire corporate equity. And so, one of the things is that the NAP broadly has failed with regards to the issue of the lazy Malay. And so this is Dr. Mahathir himself, and he's admitting, like many in 2014, quite recently, that I failed to change lazy Malays. And he's having a book launch, and the book launch is by a businessman, Anas Zubadi, which is on his left. And the book launch is called Wahai Melayu, and it translates to, the full text translates to, God will not change the fate of the Malays unless the Malays change themselves. So it's very much a reference to the supposed fatalism, lack of like initiative. So he's a businessman, he's a founder of a few companies, and he's like, but this is a very short book that's basically giving like entrepreneurial advice to Malays, saying that you need to work harder, you need to be more business-minded. And so now we come to the neoliberal era. And there's a lot of debate about whether or not like this actually constitutes neoliberal era. I won't go into that in too much detail now. I'll just one of the reasons why I see this as part of a neoliberal project is that there are a lot of privatization projects carried out in Asia during the same period as most of the world made a turn towards neoliberalism. It was called like among the most extensive privatization projects in the developing world. And one of the political goals of this was simply to build up a new class of Malay state capitalists. And that's when we come to the term the new Malay. And so the goal was not just to produce the material basis for a Malay capitalist class, but the development of a work culture and ethics in keeping with the demands of the work regime of a rapidly industrializing society. So they had to have people embrace sort of the values of capitalism as well. So now, finally, now I'm coming to the qualitative section of. So these are interviews that I did over the last year with Malays in London and in Kuala Lumpur. And I was talking to mainly like Malays who are lawyers, doctors, and bankers, and so on. And so one of the things I find is that a lot of PMC Malays accept that the lazy Malay stereotype is true. And this is something that was volunteered by them. Like, it's not something that I didn't ask them, like, do you think Malays are lazy? Like, I would say, what do you think are the features associated with Malays? And they would say, I don't know. I think people probably think that Malays are a bit lazy and useless, but that might be true. For me as a Malay, yeah, I can see it happening. I've been friends with Chinese, I can see a difference. If you ask me if Malays are lazy, I say about half of them are. Right? So not all of them. But this is not a classic case of self-stereotyping. So very much, most of my interviewees didn't see themselves as part of the stereotype, didn't see themselves as lazy. In fact, they very deliberately distinguished themselves from the mass of the Malay population. So here is Damia saying that, like, I never felt complacent. I always felt I need to be the best. Oh no, you shouldn't be like how everyone expects the Malays to be like, lazy. I refuse to be part of that. So she's very much drawing a cultural boundary between herself and most of the other Malays. Amar, who's another consultant, contrasted himself by highlighting his competitive spirit. Sandra remarked that her Malay majority university environment was very primitive backwards. So again, like, she's drawing those cultural boundaries. This allows for the stereotype to be selectively applied based on class background, where working class Malays bear the brunt of the stigma. And this is Christina, who's actually a Chinese, who I interviewed, and she talked about, so she puts it in like very, very stark terms. Like, she actually talks about, if you're talking about a lower social hierarchy, perhaps, like, of Malays being lazy, but if you're talking about the educator hierarchy, the Malays who have been foreign educated, many of whose come to the UK, of course, and who have to work for it, then they will not be lazy. And another way that I think that neoliberalism provides a useful lens to interpret this stereotype is that PMC Malays tend to explain laziness as a product of government assistance. So, for example, Damia again, she talks about how Malays are very complacent because the government has given Bumiputras all the rights. Again, Bumiputra is princes of the soil, composites Malays, in terms of education, in terms of jobs. And so this stuff not necessarily not a progressive viewpoint, because there is a big argument in Malaysia that the NEP-based affirmative action programs should be removed while defending the provisions of the welfare state. So there's a lot of calls for the affirmative action programs to be expanded in range in order to target groups and individuals based on their class position rather than ethnic background. But most of my interviewees didn't have that viewpoint. They were talking about how government assistance in itself is intrinsically unhealthy. So Anwar talked about how education is very cheap for the Malays, and that's why they're lazy. Whereas for Chinese Malays, it's more difficult. Everything has been done privately, so they have to be the best. So again, there's an association of the private sector with good outcomes. And back to Christina again, there's a very interesting quote here. She talks about how those who are not rich, those who do not get a scholarship to go overseas, meaning their parents had to work hard for it, they appreciate that it's their parents' money they're spending. Then these individuals are hardworking. So it's a very curious quote, because normally you wouldn't associate like not getting a scholarship to be hardworking. But we're talking about context where most scholarships are given by the government. So the stigma of getting a scholarship by the government is bad enough that is an indication of laziness for some individuals in the PM in the professional managerial class. Thank you. And another way we see this is sort of how PMC Malays embrace neoliberal conceptions of laziness or industry. So one thing is that resistance to labour market flexibility is seen as an indication of laziness. And so Anwar talks about why he sees Malays as lazy. If they graduate as an accountant, they want to work as an accountant. They don't want to work as a cleaner. They want to work with air conditioning. So this is sort of a very extreme view of how a logical combination of capitalist work ideology. Like, namely that workers need to be able to change job structures and without opposition and just skills according to the needs of the market. And this is something that was seen quite throughout. Another interview with Fitra, she talked about how comparing Malays and Chinese, talked about how her Chinese friends who work as Uber drivers and like said that they are willing to work 3 jobs to make ends meet, and that's evidence of their industry. And in contrast, material wealth is itself taken to be an indication of hard work. So Faiz, who is an interview in London, he said that not all Malays are lazy. I mean, I've been in London for 5 years. I see many Malays who are not lazy. They have cars, they have nice houses, so they are not lazy. Why are the Malays back home not as hardworking? So again, you see, like, the acquisition of material wealth is enough. And so, yeah, this is something that my Chinese interviewees recorded as well. So Christina spoke about how she has some Malay friends who are hardworking. She has one Malay friend who's always thinking about how to make his next big buck. He drives a Mercedes. He has 3 properties under his name. He's only 28 or 29. So, yeah, very much conception that if you're wealthy, then you have to be hardworking. So, a useful way to look at the Malaysian Malay is simply that to look at it as a racial project rather than as individual instances of sigma. So I'm using the term by sociologists Omi and Winant, a racial project as an interpretation, representation, or explanation of racial dynamics, an effort to reorganize and redistribute resources along particular racial lines. And this racial project is very much intertwined with promoting neoliberal rationality, which, as Wendy Brown calls it, the ideology which spreads the modern market to all domains and activities, even when money is not an issue, and configures human beings exhaustively as homo or economists. And in this case, this racial project is used to justify and explain inter-ethnic and intra-ethnic inequality, which is quite important because right now, if you look at like income inequality statistics, the main economic divisions is not between Malays and Chinese, which it was in the past, but within racial groups themselves. So inequality within the Malay ethnicity is larger than inequality between Malays and Chinese. And so this stereotype helps to justify that yeah, because some Malays are lazy, some are not. And of course to promote the ideology of neoliberal rationality. So, this is sum up. we're sort of seeing this tension between this panel is just about race and capital. And we're sort of seeing this tension between racial ideology and the needs of capital. So a lot of PMC Malays are very critical of affirmative action policies. So obviously The Economist is very much against this. And Malaysia's current Prime Minister, he announced at an investment forum a few years ago that he's going to end affirmative action in order to boost foreign investment. He didn't end up doing it. He ended up facing pressure because most Malays actually don't support abolishing affirmative action. There was one study done quite recently that by the Oxford School of Government that on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being not at all comfortable and 5 being very comfortable, Malay respondents were 4 out of 5 comfortable with affirmative action. And this is really because the main class articulating the need to abolish affirmative action is sort of the PMC class for market-oriented reasons. So most of the Malay working class supports the NAP not because they are lazy, but because they rightly perceive that the market expansion, into different spheres of life is against their material interests. And if given a choice between unrestrained capital and ethnic politics, people will opt for the politics of race. And so, to sum up, the left in Malaysia and Southeast Asia generally needs to articulate an alternative to both this form of ethnic nationalism and neoliberal expansion. And that's my presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan.
I'm not sure how to turn that off. I'll turn off. Thank you.
Next, we have Arzan. Let me turn this off.
I'm Alexandre Gisteleca from Romania, and I'm trying to present something on decolonialism, a sort of Marxist or materialist critique of decolonialism. I'm not sure how well established is this notion among you, the notion of decoloniality or decolonialism. I took up this critique because in the context from which I come in Romania, it is the most popular paradigm on the left, this decolonial way of thinking, whereby everything that happens or everything bad that happens is explained as a sort of self-colonization or internal colonization or interiorization of the Western gaze, which for me is a very, very unsatisfactory explanation. So I try to find out what... what is all about in this decolonial thinking. Now, the authors on which I focused are Mignolo, Dussel, Silvia Marcos, and Quijano. They are translated in Romanian. I don't know how come. The first thing from which I start is a dissociation that the decolonialists themselves articulate between decolonialism and postcolonialism. They say that there are two differences between these two schools of thought. The first one is that while postcolonialist authors are well established in the Western campuses, the decolonial authors are rather marginal and not non-integrated into the Western campuses. This, they claim, is a sign of the subversive aspect of decoloniality, while I think it could be also a sign of the poor theoretical substance of it. The second difference that they articulate between postcolonialism and decolonialism is that say that while postcolonialism focuses mostly on the concrete material history of colonization, decolonialism focuses more on a sort of internal, spiritual, or conceptual condition that is the condition of possibility of the concrete history of coloniality. So it's a move backwards from the concrete material history of colonialism to the internal condition, the internal mentality that makes it possible. So from this aspect I started and I tried to articulate three critiques of decoloniality. The first related to the colonial condition, the second one concerning the colonial history, and the third one concerning the colonial solution or the decolonial solution. Now, for what concerns the first critique, concerning the colonial condition, at first sight, the decolonial authors seem to be very ecumenical and very very open to other competing theoretical frameworks. They say that, of course, Marxism or ecology or post-colonialism are right, but they are not sufficient. There is certainly an economic or Marxist colonization, an ecological colonization, but there is something more. As they put it, they say that the colonial condition is a structure of five levels. The control of economy, nature, authority, race and gender, and of the subject and knowledge. But as it happens in all these kind of endeavors, when one tries to articulate a theoretical framework in which to integrate all the others and add something more, also this kind of description of the colonial condition is not a balanced one. Namely, these five levels are not at the same level, but because there is a primordial one which make the other possible. And of course, this original condition of coloniality is the condition of the related to the subject and knowledge. So this is the main colonial condition, the condition affecting the subject and knowledge, and all the other levels of coloniality are mere reflections of this. But this, I think, is a striking idealist move, whereby all coloniality in all its aspects, be it economic, ecologic, and so on, are reduced to mere reflections of an internal, spiritual, psychic condition. So this is a idealist in terms of its adversary. Yeah. So this idea of the dual nature is actually not characteristic to the radical core of Enlightenment, but mostly to its adversary. So this argument of decolonialists simply misses the target. The second problem of this understanding of the colonial history is that we already know this story. I mean, this is the Heideggerian, Nietzschean, or François Furet understanding of history, whereby an idea, an ideology, somehow took control of history, of the minds of the subjects, and led to such disasters as socialism or modernity as such. So I don't see any progressive touch or anything useful in in our political fight in this rendering of the colonial history as simple as a simple spell by means of as a simple spell of the Enlightenment idea. Of course, from the perspective of this understanding of the colonial history, also the appreciation of Marxism changes radically. At first sight, it appeared that the decolonialists were criticizing Marxism only for being only for being focused on one single dimension, namely the economic one. And the decolonial contribution would have been merely an enlargement of this perspective. But now, according to this understanding of the colonial history, Marxism is not merely not sufficient, but it's is from the very beginning in its essence an expression of this Enlightenment idea, hence a criminal ideology, as it appears also in François Furet and all the Heideggerian understandings of history. Which leads me to the third point of critique, namely the one concerning the decolonial salvation. Of course, again, in a coherent way, the decolonials claim that the solution, what our alternative today is, an epistemic revolution, which should consist in our changing our categories. Again, a truly idealist move, but it's also very interesting here how they imagine that this changing of categories of or this epistemic revolution should take place. They say if one reads their text, it seems that what we have to do in this epistemic revolution is that we have to change our categories, our Western infused categories, which always have a sort of tension between an internal tension with another category which is very similar but has this difference, namely that the internal tension, the internal contradiction is evacuated. Let me give you some example. For example, the concept of leading by following or mandar don't know Spanish, so leading by following. This, they say, should replace our Western concept of leadership, because it no longer presupposes a relation of opposition or tension between the one who leads and the one who are led, but a sort of pre-established harmony. Another such concept which should enact our epistemic revolution is the one of cosmovision. Again, this is very similar to our good old Weltanschauung, but it evacuates all the tension between subject and object. So the end result of this epistemic revolution is that actually we get more or less the same concepts, the classical concepts of the of modern philosophy, but deprived of their dialectic or internal tensions. This would be my final. I'm almost done. This would be my final critique. Of course, there are other examples of such epistemic revolutions. The concept of equilibrium, which again replaces the Western concept or philosophical concept of equality. Because it presupposes a sort of organic harmony, sort of organic whole. So to conclude this decolonial idea of the political solution, I think it's very much in line with its idealist grounding, and actually even goes even further, because let me put it this way, a rigorous idealist would not accept this kind of solution, because this solution is somehow contradictory. At one point it claims that concepts and ideas are what is truly effective in history, but at the same time we can change these concepts as we wish. We don't like this concept, let's pick another concept that doesn't have an internal tension or a dialectic potential. So I think this is the ultimate contradiction of this decolonial thinking, whereby even its ideal is focused on the supreme efficiency or and autonomy of concepts, seems to be replaced by the pure pure randomness of these categories. I think I'm done.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Alexandru. Lastly, we have Hilaria speaking about capitalism as post-colonial.
So thank you all for being here. I have a disclaimer, actually, to do firstly. So I'm not here as a scholar or an academic. I'm here as a militant and activist. I do completely different stuff in my life. And in particular, I'm an activist in the Italian context, which is a particular context where, when you think about the discourse on race and capital, because the knowledge production on this debate and on the colonial history of Italy is way lower in level as, and has a peculiar path, not at all comparable to the one that has happened in England or France. There is a huge denial in Italian history of colonialism. But being Italy, among other countries in Europe, one of the frontier of the European migration policies in the latest year, it calls for the urgency now for providing ourselves as activists for the theoretical tools to shape our anti-racist struggles beyond border crisis and beyond the urgency of this crisis. So what for me constitutes the political reason for the work I'm going to present are the current limit of the anti-racist practice, which for some brief analytical reason I divide into two categories. One are the educational practices and the anti-fascist practices, and the other one are the struggles against border and border restriction and freedom of movement. As I hope it will become clearer as I speak, both these type of active actions suffer from some limits that undermine their effectiveness and as radical struggles. But in a broad sense, they both translate what is an historical issue, the colonial issue, into a geographical one. So they miss the point somehow. And, well, just to be clear at the beginning, there will be some translation problems because most of the texts I used, I read it in Italian, but there are, of course, the English version, which I don't know, so maybe I'm quoting wrongly. So in order to do this, I firstly want to frame the work I'm presenting here in the specific theoretical framework which will allow me to understand what these race, racism, and racialization processes. So it may be obvious to many of you in the audience, but again, this needs to be stated open and clearly in the Italian context, in the place where little radical discourse has been produced on the topic. So the point of view I take comes from the work of Stuart Hall, where racialization is intended as a complex distribution system of hierarchies and privileges, symbolic and material both. They belong to every social relationship. So racism work on the material and real effects that are produced by this system of distribution that are specific both historically and geographically. So because of this frame, we are allowed to understand that race is not fixed and given like culturally or biologically, but it is an adaptive relationship. And it is an adaptive relationship inside capitalism. The connection between racism and capitalism, of course, lies in the colonial origins of the global capital. There is a clear shift in the way the term race is intended, also linguistically, for Latin languages. I don't know if that happened in English too. And it's specific in the moment of the American genocidal conquest. before 16th century, the relation that European countries had with other continents and other population were not so broadly racialized, whereas sometimes they were all but friendly or egalitarian. But with the Valladolid debate, the debate about whether the Indians had or not so, it's the first time where there is a great public discussion. If there was the possibility to classify other population as proper human or as subhuman, right? So the very origins of capitalistic way of production is inevitably linked to the peculiar institution of the unfree labor that will become later the plantation complex. This link is all but past history, and it requires to read capitalism in a very precise way, a one in which the type of relationship that emerge between means of production are not simply reducible to the question of who owns, so the question of ownership. Racial slavery is not an anachronistic point in the past, but it's a specific creature of capital, and its early steps that maintains their legacy nowadays. The relationship between capital and the colonial is present today. Well, this is pretty obvious. This is because capital can only produce itself through the heterogeneity of spaces, colonial and post-colonial. Fanon pointed out that colony is a place of coexistence of multi-shaped regimes for the subject that are inhabiting the colony. And this is more than true in the post-colonial spaces of the Western world. And in Italy, I will prove some example of this. There is a process that begins with the neoliberal structural adjustments, a moment in which a new kind of colonization emerged with a new international labor division. In this context, migration streams and their management create a new geography that pose labor division as international as well as international. Structurally, there are many, many scholars that underlined how capitalism tend not to homogeneity and how it does not include marginality at the end of the day. And such constitutional heterogeneity was pretty clear in colonial markets and colonial spaces. For example, has the early stream of subaltern studies made evident. These spaces were once called pre-capitalistic are not pre-modern, and they are not destined, like, doomed to disappear. Thus, institutional and material co-presence is now also here in countries of the historical center, in the very heart of Europe, and we can say that neoliberal capitalism brings this colonial rupture inside. So I will shortly make some cases of how this statement also works in the Italian context. If we use this theoretical frame, it is clear that racism is not simply a problem of the racialized one that are doomed to suffer from it, nor is simply a problem of the whites, the people who perpetuate it, or the institutions that are affected by it. Capital needs racism, and it needs also the other devices that fragmentate, separate, and discipline, not for racism per se, but for the function and structural functioning and survival of capital. Given such dependency, anti-racist struggles have to be anti-capitalist, and vice versa. So discussing race in Italy and in the European context today, and since decades, it means, of course, to talk about migration, as Balibar already stated more than 20 years ago. And the situation of the post-colonial subject is shaped with the neoliberal and migration policies in a mutual relationship between capital, migration, and nation. And on this, I agree with many scholars that point that the institution of citizenship is a crucial tool for this process. So this fictitiously universal concept that originated too in the colonial context, and it was originated by the distinction and co-present between citizens and subject. Nowadays, European citizenship ships, and I will explain why I'm saying citizenship ships, fragmentates itself in a multitude of hierarchies, hierarchies of rights and legal statuses. To bring some example, legal status of many type of migrants is constantly in a state of exception in respect to what is called the normal law. And this is true in Italy since the 90s, and there is a huge legal production of exceptionality that defines more and more special case for different migration statuses. Nowadays, recent decrees that become law in the last month, which is called Minniti Orlando, by the name of two ministers who proposed this law, pose an even more clear exceptionality in the legal system that relates to migration. For example, cancelling the second level of judgment, the appeal court, for asylum request. So for any judgment process, there are two levels of judgment, and for asylum there is not anymore. It is useful to talk about multiple citizenships, and we can call them post-colonial citizenships. Such homogeneous legal system constantly reproduced the exceptionality with expulsion and repatriation as all but extreme measure. They are constant presence in migrant existence, and they are constant presence in urban space too. So repatriation and expulsion are present in urban space, making life and presence of migrants precarious and therefore exceptional. This fragmentation and exceptionality transcend what we can see at birth conditions, at birth location. And this is proved by the fact that the recent, the current Italian parliamentary debate over jus soli, which is the law that will allow people who are born in the country to have citizenship, is brought on the parliament by the same democratic party that liberate the previous law that I was telling you about. The coexistence of different access to citizens' rights is all but new, and Membe defines it as gradual sovereignty, and they are brought in colonies by Western civilization logic. In this sense, racialized migrants are not only easily available scapegoats for the right for times of crisis, they are constituted as structurally of outsiders on a daily basis. And this is also because of the differential access to citizenship that we just discussed. This is a device that we can relate to what Stuart Hall calls moral panic. Given this, it is crucial and urgent for radical anti-racist politics parties to deconstruct and transcend any emergency discourse. It has to be acknowledged that the effectivity of racism is well beyond the ability of quickly evocate demons. It wouldn't work so well if it wasn't a cultural habitus. We need to escape this also to escape the dichotomy that was underlined by Gilroy too, where the black subject is either a problem or a victim, where the second is just another face of the exceptionality, where the subject never ceases to be an alien presence. Criticizing this victimization constitutes one of the bases to avoid what Balibar calls the UNESCO anti-racist paradigm. Thank you. So the idea that fighting against racism is to be done by education. Another reason to avoid such paradigm is that the theoretical understanding of race and racism that I just presented eludes the idea that racists are bad apples, that are pathological. As many feminists say about rapists, that they are not sick but healthy sons of the patriarchy, the same can be said about racists and racist violence. It looks clear to me after all this that the battleground that we should engage in this is the question of the rights of citizenships. We all know the cruciality of the struggle that are over border and the disruptive power that has the freedom of movement. We have to be aware that the majority of the European population is living daily and materially racism as one of the crucial devices for their exploitation, differential inclusion, and exclusion. And here, of course, I'm talking as a white person. In this moment for Italian militants, it is the moment for us to realize, too, that the becoming race of the class, and we really need to be in the process of repoliticizing anti-racism, because we are late, because racism is already clearly politicized. Anti-racist, anti-capital practices need to start from the radical critique of citizenship itself as one of the original pillar of this system that I just described. The real goal that is at stake about citizenship is not the possibility of acquiring it, and it is not the ground we should fight on, even if I don't want to deny in any way that the life possibility of some people would change by acquiring citizenship. The ground is the one of the political, not only the politics. And concluding, it has to be, I think, out and against institutions. Thank you.
So if you guys want to come up. Thank you to our speakers. We have another, I don't know, 50 minutes for comments, questions, whatever. If people have. So, there you go.
I have I'm not sure if it's a comment or a question yet for Alexandru. It was interesting because you talked about decolonialism from the perspective of very particular thinkers, which I also think can be a little problematic because it was like sort of reducing what is like a praxis for many people to the writings of these particular figures, because I think, I would have been interested if you had actually talked about practices of decolonialism, because I think that people who are trying to decolonize the university, for example, I don't think that they see themselves as doing as sort of, I don't think they distinguish themselves from post-colonial studies. I think that the argument is more that we're not in a post-colonial period, and so the work of decolonization continues. So I think like Rhodes Must Fall at Oxford, and I think decolonizing the curriculum at SOAS, I think these things, you're dealing with concepts that have material, or practices linked to ideas that have material consequences on, in those cases, students in particular. So I guess, I don't know what you think of these, or what you think of decolonialism beyond those particular thinkers you were talking about.
Maybe we take a few. And then, if that's okay.
I've got a couple of questions for Alessandro and now one for Jonathan. I thought your paper was really interesting, Alessandro, because I'm from Morocco, and obviously post-colonial theory is the main paradigm and has been so for a couple of decades. And I didn't know much about the decolonial school of thought apart from what you were talking about. So if you could still elaborate on like specific theoretical differences between decolonial theory and post-colonial theory. Second question is, obviously there's still, you know, a problem with Marxism being quite Eurocentric, you know, there's been really important works. If we think of Robinson and Gallagher's works in the 1960s, Africa and the Victorians, massive contribution to providing a Marxist account of other colonial histories. But I suppose my question is, what? Because you provided an elaborate critique, but I'm sort of wondering what would be your suggested theoretical approach to dealing with the spatio-temporal complexities of different colonial histories. And then I've got a question for Jonathan. I thought it was really interesting, obviously the idea of neoliberalism and how it alienates the individual, and when you spoke about how certain people view other people who get scholarships, and obviously because we both presented at a conference before about neoliberal resistance, so my questions would be, what are ways of resistance of malaise to the myth of the lazy man? I think what you did here is very important. That's part of resisting that myth. But if you could tell us if there are any grassroots groups actively sort of challenging this, that'd be great. Thank you.
Maybe one last question
here. Yeah, just one general question for maybe all of three presenters, and one specific question for Jonathan, which is linked to the question just raised about resistance. So my first general comment slash question is the relationship between capitalism on one hand and racism or a racialized discourse on the other hand. It seems like while there's a close intimate relationship between the two, but I wonder if there's also a certain autonomous logic of racism or racialized discourse. And for example, if you looked at a lot of post-colonial or anti-colonial struggles, it seems like colonized people also take over the idea of race and the idea of national character during the process of resistance and nation building. So which means in outside the context of capital accumulation, you still see a continuation of this kind of like racialized discourse, right? Like among colonized people. So that's my first comment. Second question is for Jonathan specifically, linking back to the point about resistance. And I'm also curious about counter-hegemonic discourse to the kind of thing you're talking about. And I want to link it back specifically to the communist movement in the late 1940s and early 1950s. I wonder, during the time of communist resistance, whether the communists, Malaysian communists, and a lot of them were actually ethnic Chinese, right? So which is kind of interesting, because Chinese are both capitalists and communists in this particular context. Now, I wonder, how did they look at interracial relationship? Did they come up with a non-essentialist kind of discourse that aimed at building a united front?
Great, so maybe we can take off the speakers and then do another round of questions.
Okay, regarding the first question, of course I didn't focus on the practice of decolonialism because I'm more interested in the theoretical background, also because I study philosophy. I know about, of course, the attempts in the UK university to change the curricula in philosophy. Of course, I support it. What I wanted to say is that I think in this specific domain, it is a legitimate practice. I mean, but what I would say is that what I tried to say also in my presentation, that one cannot change simply by an act of volition its own categories. I think there's a reason why these are the categories of philosophy, and maybe this is where you wouldn't agree with me. I do think that they are universal somehow, and I think they are universal precisely because of the internal tension of the dialectic sort of potential that is inherent in them. And what I'm afraid is that if we change them with some categories which are a priori harmonious, we lose more than we gain. I think that internal opposition or tension, which is specific to the categories of modern philosophy, is precise. Is not there. Is not. Is actually what makes them useful and great. Okay. As for the difference between decolonialism and postcolonialism, I simply repeated the differences as the decolonialists say. So it's this idea that decolonialists focus more not on the concrete history of colonialism, but on the internal condition that makes it possible, this sort of internal mentality, sort of internal interiorization of the Western gaze and so on. which I think that automatically displaces the debate between Marxism and decolonialism in a different area than the classic debate with Schiller, for example, between Marxism and postcolonialism. Because I think that while Marxism and postcolonialism do share a common materialist paradigm, and well, of course I'm oversimplifying here, but and their different positions are both grounded in a materialist, I think, historical materialist perspective. When dealing with decolonialism and Marxism, I think the divorce is already between materialism and idealism. So it's a completely different fight, I think.
So the difference, the distinction you draw, is you'd say that Marxism and postcolonialism is based on historical materialism,
yeah.
But decoloniality is a kind of psychic. But what is it? What is
idealism?
Idealism.
Yeah.
But do you mean, can I ask a point of like clarification?
Please, yeah.
When you say internal, as in, are you referring to the notion of having internalized colonial categories, epistemological categories? But that's also rooted in a materialist analysis.
No,
what is
internal
that? That gets lost.
Interiority, like a psychoanalytical level, right? Is that what you mean? What do you mean? Do you mean interiority?
That's what
I used
Is that what you were going to clarify, Rahul?
I was just saying I think that's what he was... that's what I understood.
So I used internalization or internal in two different... first one was this decolonial explanation of how ideas rule, because we internalize them, we internalize the Western gaze and so on. And I also use this that idea of the internal tension, which is inherent in the philosophical concepts. Maybe that was the idea. I think there's all genuine philosophical concepts have a dialectical tension inherent in them, and I think this is what makes them philosophical. And I think this is what gets lost when one replaces this concept with harmonious pre-established notions. What would be my approach? I don't think Marxism is Eurocentric. So it would be Marxism, I think probably the political Marxism approach of Alan Maxinswood or Brenner and so on. Because, precisely, it explains what is the specific historical configuration that led to some ideas over ruling, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, sure. So I'll start with Mariam's question about resistance to the sort of resistance, grassroots resistance to this form of racial project. I don't think there is organized resistance in the same way that Rhodes has fall or decolonization movements in universities here. But I do think that there is sort of like everyday acts of resistance in the sense of subverting the notion of laziness. So there are, so in this particular research project, I was talking to many people I had access to, which is professional managerial classmates. In my experiences talking to more working class Malays, and I did cover a little bit of that in this project as well, you have people who would say that I'm lazy, that's okay. Like you because money isn't everything, people talk about how development isn't everything. Right now in Malaysia you have flash floods partly because of construction projects. And so there is this sort of discourse which people would even embrace that we're lazy and it's okay. So I think that's a form of resistance, but sometimes it gets directed in the room. So I think sort of like the rejection, the defense of affirmative action is a sort of rejection of neoliberalism, of uncontrolled neoliberalism. But I don't think it's the most healthy form of rejection, because those are the only two options given to most nations. Which brings us to the question from the comrade over there. Sorry, I didn't get your name.
Wait, keep trying.
First of all, general link between capitalism and racism. Obviously, these two things are very intertwined. But I do think that neoliberal capitalism
part of its power comes from its purported colorblindness. Obviously, it's not actually colorblind, but its claim to be colorblind, it derives quite a bit of legitimacy from that. Like, from like, oh, we're about meritocracy, we're about you know, individual hard work. And so that's why I do think there is a tension between neoliberal capitalism and sort of like ethnocentric state management. So like, yeah, in Malaysia you have what Ai Wah Ong calls spaces of neoliberalism, which is like either literally geographical spaces where you have like neoliberal policies, or like, you know, policies selectively applied to certain populations, right? So there is a tension there. On like counter-hegemonic narratives, I don't think that the MCP, I don't think we can know whether the MCP would have produced a counter-hegemonic narrative. Like, they only had legitimacy for a very short period after independence, like, because like at that point, like, they played a very important role in the liberation of Malaya. And so at the time, the British were like, okay, we'll allow you to exist. But the moment they started actually organizing, they were immediately shut down. And then that during the Civil War in the early 1960s, as some of you probably know, like, the MCP said, like, okay, we want to be a normal political party. And the British said, no, you can't. It's either disband and be exiled or continue fighting. And so that's why they took up armed struggle. And yeah, it was overwhelmingly Chinese. There was like one Malay regiment, but overwhelmingly Chinese. And so obviously, yeah, they never got to the point where they were able to like talk about like how these counter-hegemonic narratives. It was very much, you know, survive. There is other sort of progressive movements, like I think Barisan Socialists or the Socialist Alternative Movement in Singapore, but at the time it was like part of Malaysia as well. I mean, that sort of gives an indication of what kind of politics could be. Of course, like, you know, leaders were all arrested and rounded up quite early on. But it's also dangerous about like, so like Lee Kuan Yew had this narrative of like, Malaysian Malaysia, which sounds like, it sounds like it is surpassing ethnic boundaries, right? It's like, you know, but at the same time, of course, he's actually thinking about, he wants to create a very capitalist state. So it's not enough to just want to supersede racial boundaries by saying that, right, oh, we don't look at race. Because of course, like, that just means neoliberal capitalism, which very much does, very much is regulated by race.
Thanks. Can we go this there and back there?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Is it right if I ask one question to Alexandra and one to Eladia?
Sure.
I'll try and keep it short. So yeah, thank you both. Thank you all three for your presentation. It's great. I was particularly interested in your questions because, you know, I actually did, well, I did a master's in postcolonial studies. Then I had enough of academics for a while, for I think very particular reasons. And then after a long time, I've gone back into studying, and I'm more interested in a Marxist approach to critical theory. And what I find upon entering the university in Goldsmiths is that a lot of people, and it's mostly white people, maybe that's because of the course I'm doing, but people seem to be constantly complaining about this module or this course like has such an emphasis on white men. And it's always like, even if people actually mean men, they say white men, which is a very common thing now, and it's very fashionable to include the word white with men because it's more intersectional or whatever. But basically, I mean, I'm getting tired of hearing it, even though I know that, like, it's not like there's no problem, right? Of course, there is a problem, when you briefly have alluded to it with the thing about the curriculum. Actually, I guess you mentioned that. This thing about the curriculum does, like, play on my mind, and obviously I think it's relevant to the paper that you just gave. I basically agree with your approach in your critique of this decolonial kind of discipline, or even, I mean, I would also say the postcolonial discipline, which has sprung up in the last decades, because it seems to, for me, the problem is it seems to base itself on moral grounds. Like, it's like, this is a moral necessity now, which I think is symptomatic of actually a neoliberal conjuncture in politics. But basically, I guess my question is like, how can that critique of the curriculum, which is like obviously necessary in terms of there are Eurocentric curriculums everywhere, that much is true. How to rearticulate that, but not from that perspective that the post-colonialists and so on are doing it. How do we need to alter that? And my question for you, it's I've also thought, you know, I feel like I've been saying it for years as well to comrades, is this notion that capitalist anti-capitalism has to be anti-racist, anti-racism has to be anti-capitalist, because I mean, it's just logical, because like how, if your anti-capitalist struggle is actually racist, then it becomes anti-capitalist because it unravels itself in a bad way. But in terms of like how that would be, how to move on that, I mean, I think that the whole intersectional experiment is not going particularly well. I don't think that you can just see like where do these two things like go together in a nice way. Like I don't think that, or in a nasty way, but whatever, you know. Like I don't think that that's a framework that works. So how did it, in terms of praxis, where would you move forward from that position?
I'll be back
there. Yeah, I have two questions. One for again from the same two people. I have a question of curiosity, actually, because you said you come from Romania, and in Romania, this is a very dominant paradigm that people talk about a lot. So I'm wondering why you think that is the case in the context of Romania. And then for Ilaria, you said towards the end about the critique of citizenship being the field where you think a struggle to be waged, and it's not just that. Acquiring citizenship, the question of citizenship itself, which I really agree with. The question is, how can this translate into any form of practice in the context in which we find ourselves? So in Italy, for example, or other countries that are near the borders. So you mentioned that the anti-border type of movements or educational type of projects have limits. And you can see how those limits translate into some sort of practice of inclusion. But there's a question, so then how would you question citizenship? I find it really hard to imagine that, so I'm wondering if you have any ideas.
And then one last question.
Yeah, also a couple of questions. One to Ilaria, if you could elaborate a bit on your conception of the historical development of racialization in a specific Italian situation. I mean, you drew on Stuart Hall, but Stuart Hall also reminds us of the methods we can borrow from Antonio Gramsci, who had a lot to say about exactly that specificity with respect to the relationship between the Southern question and the imperial question. A couple of things about for Alexandru. I mean, this I also find your critique quite persuasive, because I do think even for the purpose of curriculum struggles, there is a difference between seeing Eurocentrism as an epistemic problem and seeing it as a problem of ideology in the tradition of Samir Amin, who you may not remember that book, but he did present an alternative to decolonial theory, but to Edward Said's conception of Eurocentrism at the time. But anyway, I have a couple of complications that I'd like you to kind of take up with respect to decolonial theory. One has to do with the question of liberation theology and its presence in that framework. And the second one has more to do with a certain kind of argument that the very scholars that you criticize have made when they came onto the English-speaking scene, which was to say, actually, you know what, one of the specificities of decolonial theory is that it has that historical articulation, the Latin American articulation, between that particular epistemic approach and strands of world system and dependency theory. And so that was actually a claim to a more materialist alternative to the idealistic strand of post-colonial theory, the ones shaped at that time by Baba, by Spivak, later on by Chakravarti, for example. And so this is a bit of a paradox, perhaps, but then you could perhaps enlighten us about how you kind of parse that, that problem.
Maybe one last question.
Okay. Yeah, it's my turn. I'll start with Andrew. So you mentioned that there's no kind of contradiction at the heart of the theories of decolonialism, and maybe not in the area you spoke of in terms of the solution, but I guess the idea of interiority and exteriority, which is huge in relation to decolonial theory, the idea of borderlands and Mignolo and beyond the alternative, whatever, the cosmopolitan, but I don't remember all the terms. But yeah, there's a lot. So there is this idea of interiority and exteriority. Maybe it's not a dialectical contradiction, but I guess there's the book by George Ciccariello Maher, I don't know how to pronounce the name, called Decolonizing Dialectics, and he kind of takes up the Dussel interiority, exteriority, and then adds some sort of Fanonian flavor to it, and then kind of dialecticizes it, I don't know. And so I guess he tries to retrieve kind of something about decolonial thought by kind of making more materialist and historical materialist. And I was wondering if you thought that there is something to retrieve in that and a way to combine it, or if you just need to return back to Wood and the political Marxism.
Great.
Okay, I'm pretty sure I won't be able to answer all of them, but maybe this would help a bit. I think the context from which we're speaking is very relevant here, and in UK this puts me in a very bad light, because it appears that I'm defending the old traditional Eurocentric curricula. But where I come from, and probably this answers the questions from there, why did decolonialism became so popular in Romania? My explanation is that it's because it's quite in line with the dominant ideology, the anti-communist ideology, which explained, it explained communism as the expression of an ideology or of an idea which is criminal in itself. This François Furet kind of idea, whereby communism is reduced to an ideology, and the ideology is criminal because, in this respect, decolonialism doesn't add much else. It merely says that all modernity is bad because it all comes from this criminal idea, which is not only Marxist, but common to the whole Enlightenment. So that's why I think it became popular. I do know that they enter at least in a sort of a dialogue with dependency theory. But again, at least Mignolo, in what I've read, rejects the dependency theory precisely because it's still too Marxist and still too materialist. And so I don't see this dialogue or exchange as a way by means of which decolonialism finally gains some historical determinacy or materialism. I think it cannot gain any historical or materialist determinants because of its starting premises.
Okay. So I really thanks for this question that you posed, because they are crucial, I guess. So it also means that some of my message got, so great. So talking about practices of being anti-racial and anti-capital, and the problem of how some of the intersectionality discourse tends to be somehow stuck somehow, it doesn't really move in some way. I have the same feeling too. So it becomes really hard to move around and to do to actually fight back when you have to take into account many stuff that somehow put you in different positions at different points in the struggle. So what I can tell you how I got to try to understand theoretical ideas. because I think it matters. So I have a history as a feminist activist, and as a feminist activist, I pose myself to other comrades, and I want other people to question their privileges, of course. Otherwise, I wouldn't call them comrades. And for the same reason, I have to ask myself about my privileges. And this is somehow, I think, one of the ways in which you you can act, but somehow with consciousness, I don't know if that's a correct term too. And you know, intersectionality poses a lot of question of the awareness of every privilege you have and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I think many of us have the urgency to act. And that's what we should work on, that urgency is, and why we should sometimes we need to do something, you know? I think that's the point we should focus on. Of course, your question, I guess, is the hardest one. So when I was writing this this paper, I was like, yeah, this is the point how we dismantle it, right? So what I envision somehow is a sort of possibility of hacking citizenship, of working around the fact that citizenship allows you to have some access, or it allows me, for example, to have access to some possibility. And if I use that possibility to do something else, to, for example, to move people across border with my car because I can cross border and other people can't, of course, the question is how to translate this sort of hacking practices into, like, grassroots movements. They can be really individualistic in a way. So that's one of the great points to be answered. But I just want to tell you that maybe it can be useful to discuss in this. There is this this thing that Italian, some part of the Italian militant used to chant when they had a demonstration against borders, which is translated in English, paper is only paper, paper will burn. And migrant asked these people to stop chanting that, because you are chanting that as a person who has the paper, you know. So it was really interesting to me, because the people who were chanting this, they feel themselves as really radical in a way. You know, I just want to throw away my paper because the state doesn't mean anything, it doesn't mean anything to me. But we are chanting that from that position. So I don't think it's really disruptive if you don't take into account that you have those rights, right? And of course, the Italian, the discourse in Italy about race has this relationship between the construction of nation in Italy and the conquest of the South. And, well, I have to say, from my personal point of view, that I discovered that there is a colonial narrative over the conquest of the South and Italy really late, because I am born in Turin, which is the place where this conquest started. And in school, we don't talk about that as a colonial conquest. It's just the making of the nation, right? So I just discovered that when I was like really, not old, but not young anymore. And I think that the struggle is real to make like evident to people that we have a colonial history, both in Africa and internal colonial history, but I guess that somehow applied to many of Western nations. Because the creation of the nation has to do something with your internal conquest, the internal conquest of spaces information. And well, we start from like ground of other theoretical framework that have been introduced somewhere else. But well, theoretically, it's really hard to think, to understand, to me at least, if those production of theory can be applied and shaped to understand the Italian context without just borrowing them. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I think that some of those tools are useful now because Italy is in the European context, and it is part of the European policy of migration. Of course, I'm talking about racialization in Italy and in Europe, not other places in the world. So I guess it's specific to that.
Thank you. Is there any other comments or questions, thoughts? Yeah.
Just a question for Alexander. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more specifically about how much or how you see your critique, which I find really compelling in lots of ways too, how you find it to apply to Doucet, who you mentioned but you didn't really take up, and who at least, in certain respects has clearly remained much closer to Marx and the traditional Marxism than Mignola or someone like that. And so I was just curious whether you thought there were elements where this critique still applied to Doucet, elements where it might not.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is that I took them in one package.
Yeah.
Of course, I noticed there are huge differences between Mignola and Doucet. Mignola, I was shocked that someone could publish something like that. And Doucet, of course, has much substance, but I didn't see ultimately a divorce between them. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Mignola is a sort of continuation, more diluted continuation of what you said. I didn't find a different paradigm between them.
Mm-hmm.
Any last comments? How about from our speakers? Anything you want to add, conclude? Great. Well, we're finishing about 13 minutes early. That's fine. I have a quick announcement. So there's a room change for a second, sorry. 4:15 session on critiques of political economy has moved to room G50. So people know. Great, thank you very much. Cool. Thank you very much. Tell me.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.